The following episode of the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
In a seedy, rundown office in Los Angeles, a pair of businessmen discuss the opposition.
I know these guys better than I know you. Pull a gun, you gotta be ready to kill somebody.
Well, what else we got to do?
Bill Cosby is Hickey, and Robert Culp is Boggs. Hickey and Boggs, a pair of played-out private eyes who'd have to reach up to touch bottom. They're not cool, slick heroes. They're worn, tough men, and that's what makes them so dangerous. When they come up against professionals, they hold their .44 Magnums in both hands and keep shooting until they hit something, anything. Hickey and Boggs. Rated PG. Cosby, Culp, Hickey and Boggs. They'll knock you out of your seat.
Welcome back to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Freeze! Put your hands in your head!
This week, we're joined by two special guests, writer-scholar Richard Edwards of Noircast.net.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Robin of DailyGrindhouse.com.
Please, call me Sweet Lips.
Will do, Sweet Lips. This week, we're looking at the film Hickey and Boggs, directed by and starring Robert Culp. This is the first screenwriting credit for Projection Booth favorite, Walter Hill.
Don't you mean Hill's a favorite of Justin's? I mean, I recall you being simply, as you put it, an aficionado only as we did our Streets of Fire episode a few months back.
I am a aficionado of Hill, just the way that people are cigar aficionados, such as Monica Lewinsky.
I mean, has Walter Hill done anything good besides Last Man Standing?
And that's about the 18th Last Man Standing joke we've had this year. I'm glad you come up with it, though.
Anyhow, Culp stars as Frank Boggs, one of a pair of two down-on-the-luck detectives, along with his iSpy partner, Bill Cosby, as Al Hickey. The two dicks are scraping by and willing to take anything that comes along, including an ever-deepening case where they cherche la femme Mary Jane Bauer, played by Carmen Moreno. This leads to all kinds of dead ends, false leads, and some mean guys with machine guns. All right, guys, let's talk about the movie. First off, Rich, I know this was your pick. What drew you to the film? And please don't say Jell-O Pudding Pops.
No, absolutely not. I have a couple reasons for picking this film. First, just in terms of my enjoyment of Hollywood films, one of my favorite time periods are the films made between 1968 and 1975. There were so many interesting films made during this relatively brief period of time, and it introduced many in the American audience to the more modernist tendencies in filmmaking. This is the period where filmmakers of the so-called film school generation really started to get their chance to helm their own feature films, such as Martin Scorsese, Brian De Palma, and Francis Ford Coppola. Second, this is a great period of genre revisionism, especially a period when filmmakers literally start to kill off all of the standard, long-standing genre myths. And no film genre, for my money, was as demythologized as the private investigator film. In this period, the romantic underbelly of the PI story, which was associated with Raymond Chandler and really embodied on screen by Humphrey Bogart, is literally shown to be destructive and false. The PI is not an anti-hero in a film like Hickey and Boggs. He and his partner are literally non-heroes, incapable of doing anything or accomplishing anything in a universe shown to be utterly bankrupt and completely amoral. And then the final reason is just kind of a fun Web 2.0 reason, is I picked this film and actually started to become an aficionado of this film, to adopt Mike's terminology, because of a tweet from the wonderful crime writer Dwayne Swierczynski, who is currently just released his new book, Hell and Gone, as part of the Charlie Hardy trilogy. And Dwayne made the observation on Twitter that of all the films in the iTunes movie library, the presence of Hickey and Boggs might in fact be the most strange, because it's one of these films that it's very hard to find on video, almost never screened on cable, is unavailable from Netflix, and yet it can be rented from iTunes for $2.99. So I've always found that amusing. And so if anyone who hears this podcast wants to go out and see this film, it's one of those films that now is actually easy to find because of iTunes.
Mike, do you want to say something? Because, you know, I actually, before Mike and I started the show today, I kind of let him know that I wasn't that big of a fan of this film.
Well, and I'm not sure if Joe was a big fan of this film either. I think you reached out to me just last night and said that it was rather a harsh film. Joe, what were your thoughts on this one as you watched it?
I said it was a downer. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I think it could have been about 15 minutes shorter. I'm used to buddy cop movies where there's like comic rapport, you know, I'm getting too old for this crap. This one's just a downer all the way through. It doesn't let up the whole way, but I loved it. I thought it was great. A little too long.
Rich made a lot of good points, and I kind of see where Rich was going. I kind of agree with him in the sense that I think this film is a flawed film, but I think the flaw comes in the writing. And, you know, to Rich's point, and I really like it about the film, actually, is exactly, you know, what he said in the sense that Walter Hill is actually recreating the genre. He's, you know, breaking it down and reinventing it. The thing about it is this is a very typical concept. And instead of, you know, setting it up like, you know, you normally would, he's forcing the audience to solve this case as your main characters do. You know, it's not in real time, literally, but you're figuring out everything as they do on screen. And that's really inventive, especially you think about, you know, around 1970, 1971. This film gets released in 72. But you think about it, there was nothing like this that came at that time, which I think is really great. And it's really inventive. But, you know, in terms of the film, what I don't like about it, honestly, it's just these aren't likable characters for me, and they're not dynamic enough for me to enjoy them as characters. You know, I mean, Cosby's face remains emotionless until the hour 20 mark. And then another problem I have is the film just sort of skates along, you know, and on, like Joe said, it's a little long, and, you know, there really isn't a climax or something that you can get excited about in the whole thing, you know, with the exception of the shootout in the football stadium. And even that isn't that exciting, you know, so, and I'm not going to buy into anyone's theory that, oh, it's supposed to be real, because oftentimes police work isn't, you know, oftentimes police work is boring stuff, because, you know, people don't ultimately go to the movies to be bored. That's what it comes down to me. It's just, I feel like it's a really flawed film, and ultimately the point of the film for me is it reminds me of how great Bill Cosby could be and once was.
I often buy tickets for Gus Van Sant films just because I do like to be bored. I like to go to films, sit there for 20 hours, have nothing happen on screen, and just kind of sit there for a long time. Eventually I start crying. It reminds me how pointless my life is, and that's really there's nothing that I like to spend $10 on more than just being bored to death.
Right, but if I can jump in there, Mike, I think what becomes interesting is while I can appreciate discourses of boredom and maybe even the fact that Hickey and Boggs in its day never connected with audiences, and even today probably would be best classified as a cult favorite because it has such a different set of pleasures that it's trying to play with the movie audience. What I would like to suggest about why I picked this film and why I'm a huge fan of this film is that when you are dealing with trying to make a noir film in the 1970s, you really have a certain opportunity to move beyond just a simplistic nostalgic grasp of the classic noir era. And I think one of the challenges for a lot of filmmakers in the early 70s is by the time the 70s roll around and we have a counterculture and we have Vietnam, you know, still in play, and we have the paranoia of the Watergate era, the older type of noir stories in which we clearly were seeing the underbelly of American culture and understanding that there was a different depth and a different type of existential angst that was associated with the private investigator drama has to shift into a new phase in order to remain relevant. And I think what's so interesting about Robert Culp's attempt to replay the revisionism here, based on a superlative script that I will defend very highly by Walter Hill, that I think is really smartly written, is that they recognize that the only way to move this genre forward was to do something that is really risky, which is actually to show that the genre itself, the private investigator film, is bankrupt and meaningless. That is why these characters actually say in the film lines like, it's still not about anything, and there no one came and nobody cares, because the characters themselves are very self-conscious at this point that where Humphrey Bogart in the 1940s had some abilities as a character to achieve, even if it's limited ends, could still achieve some sort of ends. Here, the universe is shown to be just utterly devoid of any solution. And Hickey and Boggs actually have one of those great all-time movie sins. We ultimately, nothing really happens to them in the film, not because they didn't try, but because the universe doesn't care. that they even tried in the first place.
Well, the one thing that I really enjoy is that they're in this hopeless universe and they just kind of walk through it. They're really devoid of emotions as they're going through this film. That's just, it was interesting to see just how little reaction. There's none of that Bogart charm. And so it was almost startling to see Bill Cosby. I haven't seen Cosby in a whole lot of dramatic roles. I'm much more of a fan of, you know, Uptown Saturday Night, those kind of films. And of course, the Cosby Kids, just seeing him just so emotionless through this film. Of course, for me, the most powerful scene is towards the end when some bad things happen to him, and he's just there like, okay. He takes it all in stride throughout the film. I mean, and the thing that I like too is that, you know, usually in the Private Eye films, I mean, what was the line in Murder, My Sweet, where he's like, you know, my wallet was trying to hide under a duck or something, where it's just, you know, the finances are so tight. And here are these two guys, and like one of their first exchanges is about how they can't pay their phone bill. You know, they can pay the answering service and that's it. You know, so now they have to resort to using public phone booths to call out to their clients because they can't even afford a phone at their office.
But it even gets better than that, Mike, because ultimately when films noir end up being only about the money, that's when all of these other things that seem to be part of the heroic crusade of the private investigator, that we're going to save something more important, someone's life, maybe the values of American culture. What is so great about the fact that Hickey and Boggs are just really completely penniless private investigators who have to take any type of slimy case that goes in through the front door, you start to realize that when noir itself just becomes about the money, it becomes the most damning type of critique of this type of genre, because it's not even about whether or not crime pays or crime can be dealt with in any sense. I mean, it ultimately ends up saying that the sum total of all of our human relationships, when they are reduced to just, oh my God, it's just about the money, becomes this amazing critique that I think far too few films in the noir canon ever actually get to. It's a very deep point that actually starts to critique literally the very system upon which these films are made.
Hey, I do have to disagree. I thought Cosby was wonderful throughout this. I don't think he said a lot, but I thought the pathos he conveyed just through his facial expressions, at least I thought while watching it, you know, he wasted a lot of time with all those damn seasons of the Cosby Show, because I thought he, just the pathos again, he showed just sitting there after his, I don't know, am I allowed to give spoilers in this movie?
Yeah, go ahead. We might as well. After Rosalind Cash is killed, if anybody hates it, they can blame me. I gave the spoiler.
I thought it was great as he's just sitting there with this kind of blank expression on his face as Robert Culp is trying to convince him, come on, let's go get these guys. I thought he was wonderful throughout the whole thing. I wished he would do more of that. He would have done more than that, and less Ghost Dads, and less Leonard Part Sixes, and less Cosby Show.
Oh, come on, man. You got to give some love to Leonard Part Six. I mean, those first five movies were just absolutely brilliant.
Leonard Part Six actually rocks. For me, this film is about Bill Cosby for me, and he's the most fleshed out character as well, too. The thing about this thing, I'll go back and say it because I feel like Rich is overtaking the conversation and that he's being very pro, but I think Hickey and Boggs is very flat. I will say that I think Culp does a great job as the director here. You know, he's moving his camera around the place. He's getting good coverage, great two shots, interesting perspectives. There's some cool verite shots. He does the Hitchcock close-up. You know, but at the end of the day, ultimately, the whole thing just feels episodic. And that's something to do, I think, with the writing as well. It's very flat again. The characters kind of feel like, you know, they're out of an episode of 70s television. I mean, I'm sitting here watching it, and I'm waiting for Chips to come around the corner.
I think it's slow, and I think it's very meditative, but I don't think it's Gus Van Sant. I didn't feel bored during the film as much as I felt confused, and I kind of liked that I felt confused, at least the first time that I watched it, because I felt very much like a private detective while I was watching this and just saying, like, who are these people? Where, you know, because you will jump into a scene, and all of a sudden you've got, like, the guy from Soap there, Robert Mandan, Mr. Brill, I think his character's name was. Okay, well, who is this guy and what is going on here? And really the whole case feels hinky right from the start when Bill Cosby goes out to the beach, which is a weird place to meet this guy, meets Mr. Rice, this very effeminate guy, and he's looking for a woman. And so that immediately questions, like, well, what does this guy want with the woman? I think they make a little bit of a reference to it, and the whole thing is put into this, you know, suspicious area. And then, yeah, for the longest time, I'm just like, who are these people? How do these people connect? And it really took me a few viewings before I could get the overall thing.
One of the things that I find so challenging in talking about this film would be really setting up what Robert Culp as a director is trying to do with creating the overall mood and atmosphere of the film. And I likewise don't think I would use the word flat in exactly that same way, because when you really start looking at the beginning of this film, it really has a lot of earmarks of modernist cinema made in Hollywood between 1968 and 1975. And one of its hallmarks of that era was really moving away from continuity editing, which was a hallmark of classical Hollywood films. So when you're watching a classic film noir, such as The Maltese Falcon, the edits are all meant to be invisible, and the story is meant to be fairly comprehensible. Whereas by the time you get to the late 60s and early 70s, filmmakers in the Hollywood system start to do what Europe had been doing a little bit earlier, which was playing around with continuity editing, especially famously in a film like Breathless with Godard, inventing a style like jump cuts. And I think that's what Robert Culp is really playing with here in the first third of the film, and makes it very exciting for me, because you actually see a very contemporary editing style that is meant to be discontinuous and jagged, and it's meant to disorient the audience as much as it's meant to clarify anything. And that's part of what I think is partially something that has to be foregrounded for today's audiences, is that this was part of a moment in cinematic history where these type of experimentations with film style were taking place. Moreover, the flatness is absolutely intentional. Think about how many great scenes in Hickey and Boggs take place in public spaces that have no people in them. They're in the LA Coliseum that can seat 100,000 people, and it's five people. They're on the beach that are normally crowded with people sunbathing, and it's empty. And I think that's part of the discourse that this film is playing with. These two characters are finding themselves in a universe that is oddly vacant of humanity, and that Culp does a great job of staging that using iconic locations that should speak to sunny Southern California, and end up, we're looking at the opposite end of the telescope as Southern California, as an abyss of human experience.
Yeah, I don't know why, but while I was watching the film, while they were at the beach, for some reason, and I just don't know what it was, but I felt like it was a fake. I felt like the guy should not have been sunbathing there. It felt like it was cold for some reason. I don't know if it was because of Bill Cosby wearing that awesome suit or what it was, but as I was watching the film, I was just like, I bet you it's not that warm there right now.
You know, I may not like the film, but I, like I said earlier, I think the direction is great. You know, you're right. He probably did pull out all the stops. And to Rich's point, you know, with a flat not being intentional, it doesn't, because it's not intentional, doesn't make it a good movie.
I wouldn't make the argument that just because someone's going for flat that it necessarily will work. I guess I go with a different viewpoint, which is that Culp intentionally is playing with the pleasure of this text and is really daring the audience to dislike this film, which actually would put this film in the mainstream of a certain type of film genre revisionism that was associated probably more with the films of Robert Altman and his great taking apart of genres. And the film that's often compared to Hickey and Boggs is his version of the Chandler myth, The Long Goodbye. But just where I think Elliot Gould plays a very goofy, weird take on Chandler, I think this is a much more honest take on the Chandler myth, because the Chandler myth really comes out of Raymond Chandler's own great self-consciousness about the private detective, calling the private detective his great hero, Philip Marlowe, a knight in dirty armor. And what I keep thinking about when I watch a film like Hickey and Boggs is this is a knight that really wishes they could even afford the dirty armor. That's not even an option anymore. And I just think that that's awesome. And I think that it leads to some of the true displeasure and discomfort that watching this film creates. And that's why I'm saying it's hard to talk about, because when the goal is to really make the audience squirm in one seat, then you have to sometimes say, has the film met its goal? Even if I'm kind of somewhat awkward or unhappy with what it's making me feel about.
You know, the 1970s were just a golden age. I mean, you've brought up 68 to 75 a few times, and they were so wonderful when it came to some of these private eye films and the way that they were deconstructing stuff. You know, I wrote in my notes that this film reminded me a little bit of Freebie and the Bean. I guess it was because of the guy that goes in drag for a hot second there. Luckily, not as blatant as Sherlock Holmes 2 or anything, but there was a good moment where they're trying to draw out Hickey and Boggs, and they put one of their guys in drag. The most unconvincing drag I've seen in a long time. Definitely not as convincing as Freebie and the Bean, where they actually loop the guy's dialogue with a woman's voice to make it seem more like a woman. You know, it was interesting to see the deconstruction of that buddy cop kind of thing. You know, Joe, you mentioned Lethal Weapon, and I think Lethal Weapon does really speak to this film. The movie, though, that I think really speaks to this film, and hopefully you guys won't give me shit for this because it's one of my favorite movies, is the Running Scared with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, including the scene where they kidnap Gregory Hines's girlfriend, obviously a little less harsh than coming in and murdering her, but just the same reaction. Gregory Hines just sitting there, and you know, he's got his legs up and he's got his arms wide and he's just completely devastated. And Billy Crystal comes in and is just like, okay, we're going to go get her. And they just, for both guys, it's a now it's personal kind of moment. But for neither one of the guys, do you see that much reaction? They're just both completely devastated, which I think rings more true than a lot of reactions where it's like, now I will kill them.
But I was just going to say, I love that scene where Robert Culp is trying to get Cosby on board with, you know, the getting some payback. And he keeps on going, okay, man, fine, I'm leaving. And then he'll go out the door and come back like, is he coming? All right, come on, man, we can do this. Let's get out there. And okay, I'm leaving. Fine, you just stay here. Then he'll leave and kind of look around the corner again. And I thought that was great. And they seem kind of dependent on each other in a really sad kind of a way.
Right. And Joe, what's so cool about that scene is Culp shoots that almost completely in medium close-up with the camera on him, because we don't actually have to see Cosby in those shots because we know he's just dealing with overwhelming grief with the murder of his estranged wife. And it's just so powerful that you have these two actors. Whatever else you want to say about an actor turned director, they understand the craft. And when they have those chew the scenery scenes and it's actually the actor at the helm, they trust their instincts. And Culp's instincts here are dynamite. Every inch of that challenge within the Culp persona, and why I don't think Robert Culp was as big a star as other people who are just as handsome as he was, is that Culp was really great at playing the duality of being both a guy that you really start to think is absolutely utterly sleazy, and his wife is a stripper, he's an alcoholic, and he's a sleazy character, and yet at the other side of it, he is that guy who has that extreme loyalty to his partner. And that part is just so magnificent. And it comes out in that scene. And it's really powerful. And I think if it was even done in shot, reverse shot style, it would have robbed that scene of the one thing which really needed to happen. There was that monologue. And when they finally have the next scene, it is a scene that is truly iconic, and it's sad that this film isn't better known, but the drawing of the two weapons, of the Bill Cosby weapon, but then the understated, you know, introduction of the Magnum 44 with Culp is a great shot.
What did you think of Cosby's performance? I mean, I know Mike and Justin weren't too crazy about it, and I thought it was wonderful. I wanted to get your take on that.
I loved it. I really feel very passionately about comedians who play dramatic roles. I think that frequently comedians are able to get an additional resonance out of a role because we actually expect Cosby to entertain us. And when he withholds those natural gifts that would just roll easily off his tongue, that he could easily wisecrack his way through this film, and pulls all that back, it makes it all the more devastating. In the two scenes where I clearly would say without equivocation that Bill Cosby is a great actor, watch his facial expression when he's playing with his child on the lawn in front of his mother-in-law, and watch his expression in the bar during the Culp scene we just talked about, and you are looking at a masterclass at how glacial expressions that just subtly twitch to show what he is thinking. And of course, that's the amazing magic of films. We have no idea what he's thinking. But oh my God, it is just these moments that are just so powerful, and they're among my favorite, not only in this film, but of his career, and is, again, a tragedy that he didn't do more films after the late 70s that were in this vein. Because during this period in the 70s, if you look at Cosby's filmography, even films like Mother Jugs and Speed, these are really good films where he is playing dramatic personae. And it's just a shame that after the Cosby Show, he kind of got into either the Jell-O Pudding Pops Hawkman on the commercials or everyone's favorite dad with crazy sweaters. And it's a shame because he really, really could have been a great dark character in American cinema.
Hey, Rich, real quick question for you. In Hickey and Boggs, which is the top and which is the bottom?
I actually would have to say I think they're a switch. And I say that with all love. Because I really think one of the things to defend Walter Hill here is I love when I think about films like this is what's the title of the film? Title of this film is Hickey and Boggs. This film is not, you know, something like The Long Goodbye or The Maltese Falcon or The Big Combo, something that places the energies elsewhere. It's meant to be a two-character drama, but what are these names? Hickey. What's a hickey? To go back to your kind of sexual connotation of top or bottom, a hickey is an ugly sexual blemish that you kind of are always trying to hide up that you have a hickey. And what's a bog? A bog is a gaseous, odor-filled pit of excrement. And this is what we have as the names of our two private investigators, awkward sexual blemish and smelly gaseous pit. I mean, this is a fabulous title. All credit to Walter Hill.
That's one of the reasons why I like talking to Rich so much is because he goes that extra mile and goes to those places that few film critics are willing to go into. That let's take the thing apart and let's see where we're at with this kind of stuff. And speaking of taking stuff apart, I mean, we talked a little bit before about the whole deconstruction of the Private Eye myth. You mentioned The Long Goodbye. I mentioned Freebie and the Bean. I don't necessarily think that that took the genre apart too much, but there were other great films along these lines. I'm talking about like The Big Fix or Hammett or Chandler, Marlowe with Jim Garner, all these kind of things. I think they're fitting within that time range that you gave,
yeah.
Which, if memory serves, you're going to say that 1975 was the end of a lot of this independent cinema when all of a sudden Hollywood started realizing that there was a lot more money to be made in the blockbuster kind of stuff. And that really put an end to this whole era because you don't want to deconstruct a genre when you want to make money off of genre films. But yeah, I mean, are there any other deconstructionalist Private Eye films that are along these lines for any of you guys?
The one that I actually would be curious what you and Justin think, because I just have an idea that this might be one of the references that Walter Hill was playing with in the script, or at least Robert Culp was playing with on screen, is I've been fascinated, and, you know, again, you can keep all your sexual innuendo to yourself, Justin, but I've been obsessed with Bill Cosby's cigar. And
well, he lights it every time he gets in trouble. Did you notice that?
Right. Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yes, mm-hmm. but not only that, is who else in this time frame is associated with going on vendettas and lighting with lit cigars in their mouth? And I would argue that that's a conscious play on Clint Eastwood's persona in the Man with No Name series. And intriguingly, as opposed to Clint Eastwood, who always amazingly could keep those damn cigarillos lit. I mean, the part that I love about this film is Bill Cosby can never keep his cigar lit, which I again think is a real fun conscious play with this type of persona, showing that he has none of the power that, say, Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name has.
Going back to what you guys were talking about earlier, the part where his mother-in-law is screaming while he's trying to play with the kid. I love how that is so much just kind of a background noise. And I love the way that they use sound in this film. Do you guys have any kind of take on all of these sirens that you hear throughout the film? Because for me, it just kind of put me on edge the whole time. This kind of, I don't know, they sounded like air raid sirens. I think that they were environmental warning sirens to say the film, that the smog the film was
starts
so bad.
With, yeah, the film starts with the siren, and actually when I first hear that siren, I think of the Billy Joel song When the Lights Go Out on Broadway. Every time I heard it, it was kind of disconcerting because I kept on thinking of Billy Joel while I'm trying to watch this movie. But yeah, the sirens play throughout the movie, especially that air raid siren. But if you notice, I wanted to bring up real quick, Mike, that even after his wife has died, he's not even playing with his daughter at her funeral. He's just kind of sitting there smoking a cigar while she plays, and he still isn't engaged with his kids even after losing their mother. It was just sad. The whole scene was just heart-wrenching. punching for me.
And it really sucks to see Bill Cosby smoking in the first place. Why are you smoking? Your health is not that good. You shouldn't be eating hoagies either.
No, they eat hot dogs. How many freaking hot dogs are consumed in this movie? Seriously. Every time you turn around, I would say at least 8 hot dogs are consumed, 6 by Robert Culp.
Well, I think that's because Nathan's was a sponsor of this film. If you watch the end credits at the very end, it's special thanks to Nathan's Hot Dogs.
Yeah, that's one way to keep the catering bill low. I think this idea of the air raid sirens strikes me as potentially something that might have just been one of those happy accidents on the set that Robert Culp, you know, was filming. And instead of typical Hollywood fashion saying, you know, let's close down this area, let's wait for the sirens to pass. I think in this time period, again, one of the hallmarks of this kind of edgier Hollywood film was to let reality kind of encroach. And really the number one film in this era that was really well known by filmmakers and industry insiders was a film like Medium Cool, which was actually shot during the 1968 riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And I think Culp, for my money, was absolutely in that same type of spirit that when they went on location, if there were things happening environmentally that were disruptive, keep it, because it was fitting in his filmmaking sensibility.
Speaking of the sound used in the film, and of course, going back to tops and bottoms, because I can't get enough talking about that. Do you all recall when Lou Frizzell, Rice the lawyer, is introduced on the beach? You were mentioning that you thought he might be a homosexual or something like, but he kept on looking at those kids in a really uncomfortable way. And even when him and Cosby are talking, you could still hear the squeaky chain of the kids on the swing as Cosby kept on looking back uncomfortably at the children and talking to this guy who's like splayed very uncomfortably out on the beach. I just thought that was wonderful too. I could just hear that chain the whole time as he's making this kind of greasy proposition.
The version that I saw of this was just this really horrible transfer off of VHS on a DVD-R. Oh. But it almost added to that scene because everything was so washed out that for a while I was like, is Rice wearing pants at all? And it just, I was like, is he on a nude beach? It was so strange because his trunks just blended in with his leg.
He's not wearing trunks. He's wearing a Speedo and he is introduced with his legs splayed on the beach.
Open.
That was quite a scene, yeah.
Right. And I think that's a great point, Joe, because I think sexual perversion is one of the undercurrents of this entire film, because you also have the character of Boggs having his wife being a stripper. So a lot of scenes take place in strip clubs. And you're right. A lot of these characters strike me as very skeevy, but no more so than that lawyer. And that beach scene has tonalities that really are suggestive in ways that are really, you know, creepy to think about, because you're right. He probably is a pervert of some sort.
They're willing to take a case from anybody, even this kind of real questionable character. All right, guys, we're going to take a break here for a minute. When we come back, we're going to talk to Rich about his book, The Maltese Touch of Evil.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
GGTMC live for you. Fresh, yeah!
Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
This is Mo. He seems to have his life together, doesn't he? He has a job, a scooter, and a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. He's an all-American. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He's literally unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. I'm deadly serious. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. His addiction reached its low point when his friend Bosch spent almost 3 days incapacitated under a pile of black clamshell VHS cases, surviving off nothing but old stale junior mints, and Mo barely noticed. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes or drunkonvhs.blogspot.com. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, even save a child. A disease like this can never hope to be cured, but it can be controlled and carefully managed in small doses, or as scientists call them, podcasts. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the many members of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Thank you.
This is Nancy Allen, and you're listening to The Projection Booth with Mike and Justin.
And we're back. All right, Rich, tell us a little bit about The Maltese Touch of Evil. The title is ridiculous, and I have to know where it came from.
The full title of the book is The Maltese Touch of Evil, Film Noir and Potential Criticism. It came out of a podcast project that I do with my friend Shannon Clute, and we do a podcast called Out of the Past, Investigating Film Noir, and we've done about 50 episodes of this podcast, and when we were thinking about a name for the podcast, we selected our absolute favorite film noir of the classical era, Out of the Past, and also felt that all of our investigations of these films were going to have some sort of type of revisionary lens where we were going to revisit these films that were constantly coming out of the past, reminding us about the power and the greatness of the style of film noir. And we started that podcast around 2005, so we've been doing it for 6 years. In 2008, we were starting to come up with an idea for a book that could build on the ideas that were coming out of this podcast series, where every couple of weeks or monthly, we were investigating one film noir in depth and talking to it very much in a scholarly manner, which probably comes as no surprise to people who haven't heard me before. This is how I actually normally talk. We were really wanting to do a film analysis podcast that really looked very closely at how films noir were put together. And so by the time we were coming up with the book idea, we had about 30 episodes completed, and we thought we had enough original ideas that we could start to pull these together into a book. And as we started to pull the book together, we realized it wasn't going to work as any sort of basic transcript of the ideas we generated in the podcast, but more that the podcast kept highlighting certain moments that jumped out of films at us. And we started to really appreciate, Shannon and myself, just how deeply self-conscious noir was, that noir seemed to have this filmic sensibility where the films were speaking to each other, where filmmakers were embedding moments and ideas in their film from other films noir that were released at the same time of them a few years back. And it struck us as one of those film genres that was just deeply immersed in its own story of how you tell these kind of stories. So there's this formalism in the film noir genre that we just found delicious. But at the end of the day, it wasn't about thinking about it in any sort of scholarly sense, but really looking at it from a fan sense that said, wow, there are these moments that jump out at us. And as we started to put our book together and tried to find a way to organize these moments that would be recognizable to pretty much any fan of the genre, we recognized that there was going to be a little bit of a remix element into our book. And so we did a remix title and took the title of The Maltese Falcon and The Touch of Evil, which are traditionally seen as the first film of the classical era and the last film of the classical era and remix them to say the start points and end points of noir are irrelevant. Whether you start with these films or constantly return to them, the overall greater point is that film noir itself is one of these great remix genres in which once you watch 30, 40, 50, 100 films noir, your appreciation of the genre will only deepen as you start to see how all of these great directors, from Orson Welles to Robert Culp, are really playing in the same sandbox. And the joy is watching how these brilliant artists play with all of the pieces.
So somebody goes and picks up this book, what are they going to see? I mean, this is, you said it's not transcripts of the podcast, yeah, but what kind of stuff are you getting in there? I mean, are you deep diving in there? I know that this thing comes out December 19th, I believe it is.
Yeah, it comes out December of this year, and it's already available for pre-order over at Amazon.com. It's being published by the University Press of New England. And so it really is a book that when Shannon and I were creating it, we wanted it to appeal to both the fans of film noir and film noir scholars, because we wanted both sides of the aisle. We wanted the hardcore fans and the hardcore scholars to realize that both sides of the equation really matter, and have, and both sides, both the super fans and the super scholars, have both deepened our appreciation and our understanding of film noir. And it's not either or, and we should not be competing camps. We should really be one community that celebrates these amazing films that at the end of the day are all about some of the greatest moments that Hollywood has ever produced. So if you pick up the book, the first 60 pages of the book lay out our basic principle by which we feel it's very relevant to study film noir as self-conscious and constrained texts. And what we mean by constrained text is we also feel one of the things that makes film noir so great is it's not an avant-garde cinema. It truly is a Hollywood cinema that really respected the limitations, especially in its first incarnation, of the studio system and the limits of the studio system, what it placed on creativity and the role of censorship. And we said one of the things that makes these films so great is that they overcame the limits of their industrial production and censorship to create unique art that actually benefited from fighting against those limitations. And so if you buy the book, the first 60 pages lay out that basic premise, but then the heart of the book, the part that Shannon and I just love, and the press really went to bat for us, is we have over 150 screen grabs from 31 films noir that comprise the heart of this book. It's an unusual amount of screen grabs for a scholarly argument, and we felt it was worthy because we really wanted the films themselves to show their richness, show their secrets as much as any type of commentary. And we called that section of the book our noirime section, saying that if you really look at all of these films, they, certain patterns start to repeat over the vastness of the film noir phenomenon. And so we have all of our screen grabs are arranged by where they appear in the running time of the film, from the opening shot of Sunset Boulevard to the last shot of Gun Crazy and 29 other films in between. And you actually start to see how a kind of archetypal narrative of noir unfolds from the very opening shot till the end. And you start to see how patterns emerge at the 20% viewing mark, the 50% viewing mark, as you start to approach the conclusions that for all the difference between Chinatown and Touch of Evil, or between The Big Lebowski and The Maltese Falcon, these films are still belonging to a similar sensibility that when you map all of these films against each other, regardless of time, creator, or studio system, you come up with this wonderful moment where we hope to make noir both more knowable and more unusual at the same time.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes of Out of the Past. And hopefully folks that are familiar with our podcast will go out and check out of the Past, because everything's still out there, all of your older things, and you guys are still doing it. I mean, there was just a brand new episode that went up just a few weeks ago on Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But what I was saying before, one of my favorite episodes that you guys did was kind of a comparison and contrasting of The Big Lebowski and The Big Sleep. And I love what you guys did on that episode. It was nice that you paid such careful attention and gave such respect to The Big Lebowski, which could just be seen as a, you know, comedy film, but there's so much more going on with it. I mean, obviously the Coen brothers know what they're doing and they did a great job.
No, and it's always funny because, as you guys know, I mean, I know both you and Justin, and it's always fun when I talk with you guys, especially with Justin, because clearly, you know, my background, I have a PhD in film studies, and so it might be easy just to tag me as a scholar. But at the end of the day, what is so great about my favorite genre, which is film noir, is I still think I'm just a fanboy at heart. And I really think that ultimately, if the film itself is not truly enjoyable as what's on screen, it doesn't matter what I would write about it, because truly the first joy, the primal joy, the essence of what makes me a cinephile are films, not the writing about films. But I think at the end of the day, what becomes fun and what we tried to do in this book is we really tried to say, we want to start a discussion in which we don't want to go into looking at film noir with a lot of preconceptions, with a lot of theories. And actually, by the second page of the book, we say, if you're coming here looking for a new history or a new theory of noir, you're in the wrong place. We're probably, the book is probably best understood as a new practice of viewing pleasure, in which we return to the films and let the films teach us for a change what it is that makes them so spectacular. Because if you think about it from this perspective, the best directors of how to watch a film are the directors themselves. Every time you watch a film, a director really in those first 5 to 10 minutes is really training you on how to watch that unique object. And while it will benefit you if you've watched 10 films, 100 films, 1,000 films, at the start of every unique work of art, especially in the cinema, the director still has to establish his or her expectations for the viewing. And so I think too often we enter into these films with preconceived notions, and you might read an article on Hickey and Boggs going, I don't know if that's what Robert Culp intended. And it's like, when you get into those debates, those become the kind of loose humanity debates. You know, I kind of go, that's not what I'm talking about. What becomes more interesting is like what we've done today, I think, on The Projection Booth, is when we can share these films and talk about a film like Hickey and Boggs and go in another direction. For example, think about the discourses of Black power in this film, because I think Hickey and Boggs has this amazing understated moment where clearly, again, another marker of it being made in 1972 is the presence of these characters that clearly are modeled on the Black Panthers. And it's really not very overtly stated. There's really, you know, very little these characters are doing overtly in the story. And yet their mere presence, I think, changes Hickey and Boggs again. And a book like The Maltese Touch of Evil tries to respect that and isolate that without necessarily having to draw larger theories, but say more, this is just something that fans and scholars alike would probably like to talk about.
I liked how many different minority characters that they had in the film.
A note to any listeners, the credits of this film are fascinating, because you actually see how Walter Hill actually broke a lot of these characters into their archetypal designation, the fences, the organization, the contract soldiers. And so it has a little bit of that genre pulp feel to it as well, which is wonderful.
I never heard the term torpedo before this film. Really? In reference to mobsters. No, I haven't.
Just another name for a gunman, really.
Then again, all I watch is Roadhouse, so.
You don't need anything else. If you have Roadhouse, you have all of the movies that have ever been made put into that one. So that's actually the next project that Shannon and Rich are working on, is just a book on Roadhouse. And rather than it being screen caps from all these different films, it's every single frame of Roadhouse laid out. Yeah. Not every scene. Yeah. Every frame of the film are in their next book.
Well, you know, Eric Stoltz actually played Patrick Swayze's character for the first, like, 2 weeks of the shoot, and they decided he was too dark, and they replaced him with Patrick Swayze.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that footage to come out. Eventually, it's going to be there.
It's going to happen.
And it's tough to keep up with all of the shifting discourses of The Projection Booth. I mean, definitely, there are a lot of detours on this podcast. To go back to Mike's previous point, when he was asking the question about what do I make of the Black power dynamic, I think it really has to be expressed that this was a very unusual private investigator pairing, because you actually had a white private investigator and a Black private investigator. And clearly, in the audience's mind, this would tie back to I Spy, where Bill Cosby and Robert Culp become the first interracial team in television history, and Bill Cosby becomes the first full-time African-American male to ever lead a TV series. Of course, in just one detour that I'll throw in of my own, I don't know if you guys remember this or not, but in the series opener of I Spy, the first episode of I Spy clearly deals with racial issues and actually co-stars Ivan Dixon, who plays a Black American athlete who defects to China, and Culp and Cosby's job in the premiere episode is to bring him back to the United States. And Ivan Dixon was the director of The Spook Who Sat By the Door, which your listeners will already have heard prior to listening to this podcast. So I think Culp was always very sensitive to racial issues because characters like Bill Cosby and Ivan Dixon were part of the Hollywood crowd that actually were working behind the scenes on issues of equality, of issues of Black power. And I also think that this became a model for later films. And I know you mentioned Running Scared, but the film that I can't get out of my head is how this would not be, in some sense, Shane Black's template for Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of Lethal Weapon. And what I like about Lethal Weapon is it's very much like this film in that they don't exacerbate the differences between the Black detective and the white detective. It's really much more of age, the older detective who happens to be Black versus the young detective who happens to be white. Talk about detours, just going off really on the deep end about this, thinking about the remake, the movie version of I Spy, which was actually much more offensive. I don't think the original I Spy was offensive at all, but I think the movie version was a little offensive to me anyway, just the way that Eddie Murphy was really kind of camping it up in that film, and he was the sexual expert, as it were, in being the Cyrano de Bergerac to the Owen Wilson character throughout the film, and just being very, very, just that character that Eddie Murphy likes to play sometimes, the loudmouth, speaking a mile a minute kind of a character. And in that one, he was just completely, you know, egocentric, and he had his lackeys and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, that was, it's very interesting to see how far we haven't come when we look at the original I Spy TV series, where you didn't have Bill Cosby shucking and jiving, and then Eddie Murphy, you know, 30 years later, just completely reverses all the progress that has been made. So
what are your guys' thoughts on the upcoming Hickey and Boggs remake with Giovanna Ribisi and Tyrese?
Oh, nice. Yeah, I can't wait for that. I'm really looking forward to when Tyrese starts rapping and stuff. Every time they get to a crime scene and he raps out everything that has happened in the plot up to this point, I think that's going to be awesome.
And I think it's going to be guided by the subtle hand of B. Ratner, so it should be good. I'm looking forward to it.
I agree that I could not finish the I Spy remake. I found it so lacking in quality. I probably have only watched probably the first 30 minutes of it on cable and just can't get farther. But I think that is such a great point that is easy to lose about this moment from 1968 to 1975, to go back to a question I was asked a long time ago. But what was interesting about 68 to 75, and I wonder if you guys feel this as cinephiles like I am, but it really felt like there was a great ambition in Hollywood. And whatever you feel about Hickey and Boggs, whether it works for you or doesn't work for you, I would hope that most people listening to this podcast would at least have a begrudging respect that Bob Culp did not take the easy way out. He had a likable sidekick, and they could have just done this as a shticky private investigator film and made money. He followed his artistic gut and never was able to direct another film. And you have to respect that. But what ends up happening is, I keep going back to these numbers, 68 to 75, because you're really dealing with the collapse of the studio system and the rise of independent productions prior to two important events. And that is the blockbuster status of Jaws in 1975 and Star Wars in 1977. And to be overly simplistic about this, I still feel that between 1968 and 1975, filmmakers in Hollywood were trying to make the great American movie. And by 1977 and after, and we're still, I think, in this period today, they're trying to make the great American hit. And it moved from trying to make just great, awesome movies to making money. And again, as I said, just as it is the death knell for noir itself, when movies become just about checking that Friday box office gross, you know, just stick a fork in me. I'm done.
Well, I can't think of a better way to wrap it up than that. Just so folks know, for a lot of time, a long time, as Rich was saying earlier, Hickey and Boggs was unavailable on DVD. Finally out legitimately now as MGM's Screen Archives program. You can check that out over at screenarchives.com, along with a lot of other overlooked and forgotten titles. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap this bad boy up.
Everybody! Clarence Illion is here! And he's going to tell you a little bit about Eternal Life!
Listen, I was thinking about this as you guys were talking a few minutes ago. I think it's really a dick move for us to have Joe on and not talk about his website, The Daily Grindhouse.
Well, maybe I wasn't mentioning it because I wanted to save the best for last. So, Joe, what's going on over at Daily Grindhouse? What kind of stuff can we expect to see from you?
Well, we got a lot of great stuff coming up on tap. We currently have a feature filmmaker being Jack Sholder, who, of course, did Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, The Hidden, and Renegades with Kiefer Sutherland and Lou Diamond Phillips. He has a lot of interesting tips for filmmakers and an interview on there. We also have interviews with the likes of Michael Berryman, Danny Trejo, Fred the Hammer Williamson, and some up-and-coming filmmakers like Jen and Sylvia Soska, who did, of course, Dead Hooker in a Trunk, and Dustin Mills of The Puppet Monster Massacre, which are great indie films if you're not familiar with them. And probably the biggest thing we have going on right now is we're going to be starting our own podcast soon called the Bastards Roundtable, which will be covering the Barry Gillis classic Things. And of course, as with everything on dailygrindhouse.com, we do it with our trademark love of profanity and total disregard for grammar.
Punctuation optional?
Capitals wherever you please.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, as sophomoric as possible is what we push on our writers.
All right. Well, that sounds like something that Mondo would be writing for if he wasn't writing his own blog. Now, Joe, I know you were pasting screen grabs like crazy of James Woods from Hickey and Boggs. Can you tell me a little bit about your obsession with Mr. Woods?
I thought it was kind of an interesting choice by Robert Culp to have James Woods portraying Bill Gates in Hickey and Boggs. But the most interesting thing were the white bun hugger for the limited amount of screen time James Woods has in Hickey and Boggs. I would say a quarter of it, he's wearing white bun huggers, which are very flattering on him, by the way.
Oh, of course. I mean, well, because the guy's only like 20-some years old at the point. I mean, he was super young in this one. It took me a few minutes to even realize that that was him. Oh, and I have to give a special shout out to the guy that played one of the older cops, Papadakis, Vincent Gardenia. He was just like playing to the hilt that older seasoned cop who is just not taking any kind of guff off of these private detectives. He really reminded me of Alan Arkin in So I Married an Axe Murderer, just kind of really going all out. You know, I was surprised there wasn't, making a reference to one of Justin's favorite movies, I'm surprised there wasn't steam coming out of his ears like Last Action Hero. So that was pretty good. And I just wanted to say before we wrap this bad boy up that I was super happy to see Culp in this film. Culp not necessarily playing the same slimy guy that he usually does. Of course, I'm very familiar with him in Greatest American Hero, but he was always good as a villain in Columbo, so that was always great to see whenever he would show up. You knew that Columbo was in for a ride for his money. So, all right, so that's all the time that we have this week. Thank you guys for coming out. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
And thanks, Rich. Really was great to hear from you and have you on our podcast for a change.
I appreciate it.
That was great, Rich. I am an awe, sir. Just want to throw that out there.
Well, you got to make sure you go back and listen to all their old episodes over at noircast.net. Some great stuff there. So thanks again for listening. Be sure to check out more episodes of The Projection Booth on iTunes via Stitcher or over on Jackalope Radio.
I'm on Jackalope Radio.
Or you can stop by over at our official website, projection-booth.com.
All right, is this the take or what? All right, okay, everybody. Here we go.
Yeah, that's right. All that's good.
It was 20 years ago today that Sergeant Pepper taught the band to play. And they've been going in and out of style, but they're guaranteed to raise a smile. So may I introduce to you the act you've known for all these years, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Oh!
Sing it, children.
We're Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Sit back and let the evening go.
Boys.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's wonderful to be here. It's certainly a thrill.
I hope so.
You're such
you might like to know that the singer's gonna sing a song, and he wants you all to sing along. So let me introduce to you the one and only Billy Shears.